right. Hi, everyone. So it's good to be here with you all. Just about 5 minutes ago, I thought I wasn't going to be because our internet quit working, but it was a brief outage, so I'm back, and that's a lot of fun. For the radio, this is Regina, and we are here for the Guiding Light now. And last week in the Guiding Light, I was reading from John chapter 12, the end of John chapter 12. And one thing that we read last week, it's really has just been with me all week. It's almost like last week's Guiding Light lesson hasn't stopped yet. Right at the end of the hour last week, we were reading this from the Bible. Jesus said, as for the person who hears my words but does not keep them, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world but to save it. And then he says, there is a judge for the one who rejects me and does not accept my words. That very word which I spoke will condemn him. And the interpretation that came to my mind as I read that last week was, this is a matter of the nature of duality. As long as we continue to believe the ego mind, we are in duality. And as Robert Adams says, in duality, for every up, there is a down. You can't have purely positive duality. If you do not make the choice to wake up, then you will continue to experience both the ups and the downs of duality, which are often called pleasure and suffering, both. And actually, yesterday I made a Facebook post that was very closely related to this. Let me just take a moment to pull up Facebook, and I will just read that post to you, since it's really along the same topic. My internet's still moving a little slow. In fact, Safari just closed on me. Let me try that one more time. We have sluggish internet right now, but we do have internet. All right. All right. Here is the Facebook post that I made yesterday. Quote 827 from the Seven Steps to Awakening says, one should carefully investigate the bliss of liberation and the sorrow inevitable to ignorance. In audio 2 from my visit with Michael Langford, Michael and I got into a discussion about why a human could or should desire manonasa, which is the final end of the ego. That discussion takes place starting at about the 15-minute point on audio 2. In that audio, Michael said a person could desire the end of human sorrow and suffering and therefore desire the final end of the ego. To that I replied, in my case, I haven't experienced a lot of sorrow and suffering, so it's not a huge motivator for me. Michael responded, as far as the sorrow and suffering aspect, that is a perfectly good motivation for all humans, even someone who in this lifetime hasn't experienced that much. And let me tell you why. Because in the trillions of future incarnations, you're going to find out what it's like to be in a war thousands and thousands of times. in trillions of future incarnations. You are going to experience every disease that has ever been known, thousands of times, over and over repeatedly. I don't mean in one lifetime. In one lifetime, it'll be one disease. In another lifetime, it'll be another disease. You'll experience thousands of wars, thousands of acts of violence. There are so many forms. It will get to you eventually. It's just a fact. It's just simply a fact. It's in the nature of things. It will happen. In the audio, I pointed out that Michael was looking at me with a deadly, serious look when he shared the information above. A couple of my friends reacted with fear from this part of the audio. One friend asked Ellie Ruzdar if this was true. In the exact wording of her question, you could hear how desperately she wanted to deny this, and she wanted Ellie to tell her this wasn't true. However, Ellie confirmed that this teaching is true. The entire situation described above, along with quote 827 from the Seven Steps to Awakening, has brought this to my attention. Forgetfulness is a necessary aspect of ignorance. Forgetfulness not only forgets the truth, it also necessarily forgets the fullness of the sorrow and suffering of the ego illusion. The ego does not let us see the entire ocean of human suffering, because then we would realize how necessary it is to bring the ego to its final end. If we remembered all of the pain, all of the sorrow and suffering of human and animal existence, we would be desperate to bring the ego illusion to a final end. Forgetting the sorrow and suffering of the ego illusion is an ego preservation strategy. Here I sit on my purple sofa in a beautiful home in a peaceful community. Although I'm not rich by today's standards, I have more than I need. My daughter is healthy and happy. This is a good life. This life can also be a trick of the ego, because this comfortable life, which affords fewer distractions and can be used to strive for the final end of the ego, is also full of forgetfulness, and so lacks the desire that the remembrance of sorrow and suffering would bring. What a trap! In a life full of war and disease, we are too distracted by our problems to strive for the end of the ego. During a life when those problems do not exist as distractions, they are forgotten, so we do not have the motivation to strive for the end of the ego. We are like Jesus's rich man in the Bible when Jesus says, "It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of God." I realize now that I fell for one of the ego tricks that Michael warns us about in The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss. When Michael speaks of sorrow and suffering as a motivation to increase the extreme desire for liberation, I thought, this does not apply to me. I even said that directly to Michael on audio 2. This explains the deadly serious look that he gave me as he explained how this does apply to me. So now I am going back to the Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, Chapter 5, Choice A and Choice B, with new vigor to overcome the false bliss of forgetfulness, which makes us too comfortable to actually be motivated to end the ego illusion. And that is exactly what I heard Jesus saying here last week as well. I heard Jesus saying, "I will not judge you if you don't listen to my words. You don't have to worry about that. You know, I didn't come here to judge anybody. However, that doesn't mean there isn't a consequence." Right? Just the fact that you continue to believe the ego illusion means that you will continue to experience the ego illusion, both the good and the bad. And in fact, let me grab the Seven Steps to Awakening. Here's another quote in the Seven Steps to Awakening. The one I had just read to you at the beginning of that thing from Facebook was quote 827. Again, quote 827 said, "One should carefully investigate the bliss of liberation and the sorrow inevitable to ignorance." And, you know, A Course in Miracles says that the Holy Spirit teaches through contrast. And it seems like this quote is making the same recommendation, really, that if we investigate the bliss of liberation and the sorrow inevitable to ignorance, that through that contrast, we will obviously begin to really strongly desire the bliss of liberation. Let's see if I can find. Yeah, here's quote 825. Listen to 825 from the Seven Steps to Awakening. "By self-knowledge, rid yourself of the problems connected with the life hereafter. There is no time to lose, for life is ebbing away all the time." So this quote is really giving us the same warning that Michael Langford gave me. You know, you don't know what your next lifetime is going to be like. It kind of reminds me of something that Bob Ferguson said to us when we had him here in the sanctuary, and I think it was March. Bob Ferguson said, "Do you trust yourself enough to die?" Meaning, you know, if you die and you're still highly connected to the ego illusion, the belief in me, again, you don't know what your next life is going to be like, right? So this message is just showing up everywhere, which I think is quite interesting. When a message keeps showing up over and over again from several different sources, you know, I'm not trying to make the message show up for me, right? But it is showing up for me, starting with Michael Langford telling me, and then coming across it with Jesus here in the Bible, and then coming across it in my study of the Seven Steps to Awakening just by going to the next quote that I've finally reached. You know, this message is coming again and again. And so when a message does that, I give it my attention, or at least I start to give it my attention. And again, this most recent quote that I'm currently contemplating, quote number 827, "One should carefully investigate the bliss of liberation and the sorrow inevitable to ignorance." That, of course, is the recommendation of Michael Langford in Chapter 5 of The Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, which I think I mentioned this briefly at the end of last week, but I think today I'll just go into Chapter 5 a little more. Chapter 5 in The Direct Means to Eternal Bliss is called How to Awaken the Extremely Intense Desire for Freedom. And this morning I was watching a little Ellie Ruzdar video. I'm watching one a day. They're only a few minutes long. I watch one a day prior to meditation. And in the video that I watched today, she talked about this intense desire for freedom, for liberation, for awakening. And she said, she gave a description of what that intense desire may be like. It's a very familiar description, but let me share it with you again. She said something like, for example, if I put your head in a bucket of water, if I put your head in a bucket of water, you know, you're going to be struggling with me somewhat because you want air. She says, but if I continue, she goes, that's like the desire for awakening, you know, that desire for breath. And she says, but if I continue to hold your head in that bucket of water, you're going to struggle even more. And she says, that's like, you know, more of the desire for awakening. And she said, but if I continue to hold your head under the water, eventually you are going to set yourself free with a kick, is what she said. And in my mind saw, you know, us just knocking the hell out of Ellie, right? Knocking the hell out of Ellie, knocking her away from us so that we could get that air, you know. I mean, we became so desperate for air that we just knocked Ellie across the room. But that desperation, she says, is what's needed to awaken. That desperation where we knock Ellie across the room so we can get some air, that intensity. And we know that this is not the first time we've heard this. This is also in Michael Langford's books. I've seen Ramana Maharshi talk about this, as well as other teachers, although I don't remember who. It's a very common analogy, but it's a very clear analogy. So Chapter 5, How to Awaken the Extremely Intense Desire for Freedom. Let's just listen to a little bit of this. The primary means to awaken the extremely intense desire for freedom is to carefully examine these two choices every day until the extremely intense desire for freedom awakens. And of course, these two choices are choice A and choice B. That's what he calls them. Choice A is to choose the end, is to choose to end the ego, the imposter self, by dropping all unnecessary activities to create the maximum amount of time every day to practice the most direct and rapid means to eternal bliss. The most direct and rapid means to eternal bliss is the awareness, watching, awareness method described in Chapter 7. Choice A is infinite, eternal, awareness, love, bliss, with no sorrow and no suffering. Choice A is eternal life. Choice A is to live as your true self forever. Choice A is absolutely perfect joy. The above is a summary of choice A. Choice B is being identified with a body subject to suffering, disease, death, violence, anger, fear, etc. Choice B is to allow an imposter called the ego to pretend to be yourself and to control you. Choice B is to allow an imposter that has created all the wars, diseases, death, suffering, and evil that every human has ever experienced to continue. Choice B is to have a temporary and therefore futile life that only leads to death. That is a summary of choice B. And this chapter continues from there. And it's actually, I reread the chapter very carefully yesterday. I'll probably reread it again today. It's a very good chapter. If anyone hasn't read it, I recommend it. But since we're here for the guiding light, I will stop there. But this is what Jesus seems to be saying in John. He's saying, I won't judge you if you don't listen to my words and practice as I'm teaching. However, there is a consequence, right? You could say divine law itself has judgment in it, has judgment built in. As long as you believe in the ego and the ego illusion, you are destined to experience sorrow and suffering. And as Michael Langford said to me, it will get to you eventually. And I'll say something that's not exactly pleasant, and not everybody likes to hear things that aren't exactly pleasant, but let me just say it anyway. As a result of this clarity that I shared with you from Facebook about how, you know, forgetfulness, really turning away and not looking at sorrow and suffering can be an ego trick, because then we don't have that intense desire that Ellie talked about, like when our head is being held underneath water, and you know, where we knocked Ellie across the room so that we could get free of her grip in the bucket, right? We don't have that intensity when we forget the sorrow and suffering that's caused by the ego. So as a result of that clarity, this morning when I opened up the internet and there was a story there that I normally would not have clicked on because I would not have wanted to read those details, I went ahead and read those details. And then this afternoon I turned my computer on a second time and it offered a second story, which I also went and read. And before I tell you what the stories are, I just want to tell you how I read them. When I read the stories, I read them with the clarity in my mind, this is what the ego creates. This is why the ego has to end. That's the clarity. Knowing that, again, even my fairly benign ego mind is just as much a part of creating these appearances as any other ego mind. you could say there is no innocent ego, although we don't want anyone to feel guilty. So you sometimes have to be careful because people hear these things through the filter of guilt. And this isn't meant to be heard through the filter of guilt. It's meant to be heard through the filter of sobering clarity, which is a different filter. So when I read these articles today, I read it with that sobering clarity. This is what the ego creates. In fact, again, turning back to Michael Langford's chapter 5, let me find this one piece and read it for you again. When Michael Langford is sharing choice B with us, one of the sentences is this: choice B is to allow an imposter, the ego. Choice B is to allow an imposter that has created all wars, diseases, death, suffering, and evil that every human has ever experienced to continue. Right? That's choice B. That's what happens if we do not listen to the teachings and practice them. We're allowing this to continue. So that's the sobering clarity. And so when I read these stories, I read with this sobering clarity. So there were two stories that came to my attention today. The first one was a story in Dallas, Texas, of a woman who was attacked and basically eaten alive by a pack of dogs. And this happened in a neighborhood where it's a poor neighborhood, an African-American neighborhood in Dallas, where the neighbors don't care enough to keep their dogs tied up, even if they know their dogs are vicious. And the dogs hang out together. They form packs in this neighborhood right in the city. And this woman was walking in her neighborhood, and she was attacked. The attack lasted around 19 minutes, I believe. And during this time, other people tried to assist and couldn't. The dogs, they couldn't get the dogs off of the girl. They called the police. It took the police a long time to come. And I've never lived in an African-American neighborhood, but it's often reported in the news that sometimes the police response there is slower. Of course, it can even be slow here, so I don't know if it is actually slow or not. It can be slow here, too, but we're out in a rural area, and it takes time to drive from the police station to wherever you are, but it took time for the police to get there. But you can hear the people calling 911. You can hear the fear in their voice. There were two different recordings as they're trying to get some kind of help for this girl who is being attacked and bitten hundreds of times by a pack of dogs. And so I look at that. And not with fear, with sobering clarity. And I say this is what the ego creates. And I have compassion for this woman that I've never met and now never will because she is gone. I have compassion for this woman, and I realize that type of experience could be my experience, and based on what Michael Langford is saying, at some point will be my experience if I do not dedicate myself to ending the ego, quit playing games. And then the other article that came to my attention this afternoon was a 17-year-old girl. It might have been Pakistan, but I don't remember for sure, who eloped with her childhood sweetheart. He apparently had proposed and asked the parents many, many times for permission to marry, and it was never granted, so they eloped. And the mother and brother of this 17-year-old girl tied her to a cot, poured some kind of fuel all over her, and burnt her alive for eloping. And the article included a picture of her, and of course she was a lovely young girl. And I look at that with the sobering clarity, and I say, this is what the ego creates. And just as Michael Langford tells us, this ego needs to end. And this is, again, what Jesus is saying here. At least that's the interpretation that came to my mind. So that's how I was to see it last week. He says, I don't judge you if you don't listen to my teachings and practice what I say. But there will be consequences. And for me at this point, I think that fear, you know, fear of these consequences might, in an unhelpful way, lead one to seek the end of the ego. I don't think you can end the ego out of fear. So in an unhelpful way, right? Fear of these consequences would lead one in an unhelpful way to seek the end of ego, and I don't know if that would work because the intention underneath would be wrong. It would be a protect me intention. I don't think you can end me with a protect me intention. It doesn't seem to work. So I don't think the fear is helpful, you know, if someone feels fear at this. But that sobering clarity is different. That sobering clarity, the closest that I could describe would be like suddenly realizing that something I had been doing every day just as a matter of habit was really hurting another person terribly and saying, oh my gosh, then I don't want to do that anymore. You know, it's not a selfish intent. It's a selfless intent. That's what motivated Buddha, right? We all know that Prince Siddhartha was motivated by the selfless intent to end the ego's suffering. So looking at what the ego does with that selfless intent, but that clear sobriety, that very clear, sober looking, this has got to end, I think can be extremely helpful. At least that's the way it seems to be appearing for me right now. So with that said, why don't we go to our song? Our song today is one that you probably all know. This is Michael Jackson, Man in the Mirror.
Oh,
Song where it says, I'm going to make that change today. You know, meaning right now. I love that line. All right, so we're going to start today. John chapter 13. Jesus washes his disciples' feet. So as usual, I'll read the entire story. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? Jesus replied, You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand. No, said Peter, you shall never wash my feet. Jesus answered, Unless I wash you, you have no part with me. Then, Lord, Simon Peter replied, Not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well. Jesus answered, A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you. For he knew who was going to betray him. And that was why he said, not everyone was clean. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. Do you understand what I have done for you? He asked them. You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth. No servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. So we have a Jesus who knows that death is impending. And in the story as it's unfolding, it's really two deaths that are unfolding. First, we will experience the death of the ego with Jesus when he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. And then shortly after that, within about 24 hours of that, the death of the body. So two deaths are coming. Bam, bam. And we have a teacher here who in some way is aware that an end is coming. You know, the Bible, of course, says that he knew exactly what was coming. We don't know that for a fact, but it does appear that he had some kind of an intuition. And we have a teacher who admits that he is the teacher. I mean, he knows. He can see. He knows the difference between his clarity and those who follow him. He knows that he sees more clearly than they do. And this is not egotism. this is, again, just reality. Just like if you're an adult, you know that you see more clearly than a five-year-old child. Right? It's just the way it is. So he knows that he sees more clearly. But he also knows that his time is about to end. And he may also, to some degree, know that when his time ends, this entire teaching is going to continue through these men who are not as clear as him. And so one temptation that will surely arise is the temptation to think that they are special. Special for even having known him, otherwise for teaching his message. And so what he is teaching here is humility. I'm grabbing NTI. I'm going to read to you from NTI Luke chapter 9. It will really bring home this message of humility. Let me see. I don't know where the part is. Let's see that I want to read, so I guess I'll just start at the beginning. So this is NTI Luke chapter 9. Everyone who reads my word, listens to my word, and practices my word, teaches my word. There can be no exception. You who are reading this now are my holy teacher. Do not let this make you afraid. Do not worry about what is expected of you based on this assignment. Nothing is expected of you except one thing, that you listen to me. Do not worry where you are to go, what you are to do, and what you are to say or to whom. Do not worry how you are to teach. I may have you teach without a single spoken word. Give no thought to the future. Give no thought to how you are to teach or when or where. Only give thought to listening to me and practicing as I ask you to practice. In this way you do teach, and the lesson you teach is heard throughout the world. I don't know if I should continue or not. I'm going to skip a few paragraphs. Although they're good, I don't know if they fit as much with what we're looking at right now. So I'm skipping down a few paragraphs. Although I may guide you to speak, it is not through your speaking that you teach. Although I may guide you to go or do, it is not through your going or doing that you teach. To speak to those or to go here or to do that would be to limit your teaching to a few. You, who are unlimited within yourself, cannot be limited by restrictions such as these. So it must not be through your speaking or your going or your doing that you teach. Every thought that you think is heard literally around the world. The consciousness of man is shaken by your every thought. And so it is through thought that you teach, no matter what you are saying or doing, and no matter where you are. And so I say to you again, dear teacher, listen to me, remember my words, and practice all that I say. So, what Luke chapter 9, NTI Luke chapter 9 says to me is, the way that you are the teacher is by being the sincere student. In other words, I am a teacher because I spend personal, dedicated time daily, very, very focused, not doing anything else, meditating and contemplating, going deeper within clarity and deeper within realization. That's what makes me a teacher. Whether I post that clarity on Facebook or not, whether I come here and share it with you through my voice or not, are totally secondary. It's that time alone that I spend on my purple sofa that makes me the teacher. And it's that time alone that's going to continue to make me the teacher. If I ever stop being the student, my teaching activities may even increase. Maybe I stop being the student because I became too busy traveling all over the world teaching others, right? But the moment I stopped being the student, I also stopped being the teacher. Even if I appear as a teacher, even if my big face is on giant posters and people are paying lots of money to come see me, even if people are calling me teacher or guru or whatever, if I stop being the student, the moment I stop being the student, I also stop being the teacher. So Jesus is teaching humility to a group of men that he knows when he is removed from the planet physically, that he knows are going to be the ones to carry forth the message to the best of their ability. He sees that their clarity is not the same as his. He knows that. But they're still going to carry on this message to the best of their ability. And he wants them to understand the humility of being the student. Because you know what? Whatever their clarity is now, if they are the student, if they spend hours every day first being the student, that clarity is going to increase. It's going to shift and change and become more clear. And of course, they will then be better sharers of the message. But if they see themselves as the teacher, you know, we lived with the master, he told me this, and they forget to be the student, it's all going to be mental. It's not going to be, you know, coming from what we call the Holy Spirit. It's all going to be mental and to be honest, rather dead. It'll be a dead message. This is an important message for all of us. The question really is for each and every one of us. Do I take that time every day alone with my inner Lord? Every day. Do I put that at the top of my priority list before everything else? Because that's humility. Now, we could define humility in other ways. We could define humility as, you know, feeding the hungry or not bragging. Not bragging. But true humility is being the student and remaining the student. And being the student every day. Yeah, I think that's all I have to say about that. So I will go on to the next story. The next story is called Jesus Predicts His Betrayal. I am not referring to all of you. I know those I have chosen. But this is to fulfill the scripture. He who shares my bread has lifted up his heel against me. I am telling you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am he. I tell you the truth. Whoever accepts anyone I send accepts me. And whoever accepts me accepts the one sent who sent me. After he had said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit and testified, I tell you the truth. One of you is going to betray me. His disciples stared at one another, at a loss to know which of them he meant. One of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, was reclining next to him. Simon Peter motioned to this disciple and said, Ask him which one he means. Leaning back against Jesus, he asked him, Lord, who is it? Jesus answered, It is the one to whom I will give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dish. Then dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, son of Simon. As soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. What you are about to do, do quickly, Jesus told him. But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him. Since Judas had charge of the money, some thought Jesus was telling him to buy what was needed for the feast or to give something to the poor. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out. And it was night. Well, as you all know, in A Course in Miracles, Jesus says this isn't a true story. As we've already seen, just in our own study of the Bible, it is a mistake to believe that these stories are true stories. We've seen one story, the story about the adulteress who the men were going to stone. And then Jesus, you know, said, if one of you has not, the one of you who has not sinned, cast the first stone, that whole story. We have seen that that was actually added hundreds and hundreds of years later. It was not in original manuscripts. We also, if we were to do a study of the four Gospels and compare details, we would see that the details vary sometimes greatly. So to read these stories as absolute literal truth is a mistake. To read these stories as teaching stories that have something to teach us, and then to let that inner clarity arise while you read the story, which of course is what I do during the Guiding Light. That's the most helpful way to read the story. So when I read this story about Judas, what comes to my mind is what Jesus said in A Course in Miracles, that he never could have said that Judas betrayed him because he did not believe in betrayal. And although I have no idea what happened 2,000 years ago in a room that I wasn't in, I trust that. And the reason I trust that is because I myself have already let go of the belief in betrayal. And so I know for a fact that if Jesus had let go of the belief in betrayal, he could not see Judas as betraying him. If the story is at least partially true, meaning that Judas was a follower of Jesus's and for one reason or another ended up turning Jesus into the Sanhedrin and, you know, leading the temple guards to Jesus so that he could be arrested. Assuming that part of the story is true, and it may be because it shows up in all of the Gospels, right? The way Jesus would have seen this if his mind was healed of the belief in betrayal is he just would have seen Judas as confused, believing the ego, and he would have had compassion for Judas, and he would not have interfered. He would have allowed the script to unfold. And if anything, that's what this line means when it says, "What you are about to do, do quickly." That would symbolize that deep, deep acceptance, that deep, deep allowance of what was about to happen, but not interfering, not trying to stop it. Now, of course, I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again because now is the appropriate time, about how the belief in betrayal died in my own mind. There was someone that I seriously believed had betrayed me, and probably if I was to tell the story with the details, especially back then, if I had gathered you guys together and say, "Look what he did," you all would have been, "Oh, I can't believe that." And, you know, you probably would have bought into it with me. And I was really suffering. Sometimes suffering is such a great benefit. I was really suffering from how this story was spinning in my mind over and over again. And I wanted to let go of this grievance. And I would, you know, close my eyes and say a prayer in all sincerity, and I would let go of it. And then I swear to you, 30 seconds, it was right back. I just, no matter how much I tried in all sincerity to let go of this grievance, I couldn't. It was like a yo-yo or a boomerang. I couldn't get rid of it. And now I know the reason I couldn't get rid of it is because I was still holding on to the core belief that caused it, right? This went on for like 9 months. This was not a minor event. And one day I was talking on the phone with a friend, and the purpose, the intention of my talk was not gossip. And I had not told this story to anyone. This story had been my secret, what this one had, quote, done to me. But I was suffering so much from the grievance, and I wanted to be free. So I was talking to a friend that I trusted and telling the story for the purpose of looking at it with a friend that I trusted. Because looking at it alone, I hadn't gotten anywhere, right? So I'm telling this story of what happened. And all of a sudden, as I was telling this story, in my mind's eye, I saw every single person I had ever thought betrayed me standing in like a line, all the way back to the very first betrayal, which was in fifth grade. And what I saw was that every one of those people in that line, I had defined a specific relationship with them. Like that person in fifth grade was my friend. You know, that person later on was my boyfriend. That person later on was my brother, my physical brother. That person was my employer. That person was my employee. That person was my spiritual teacher. Right? I had defined a relationship with each of them. And then, based on that defined relationship, I had rules in my mind about how that relationship was supposed to be. You know, how friends are with each other, how siblings are with each other, how co-workers are with each other, how a spiritual teacher is with the spiritual student, etc. And then, in each of these cases, the individuals in the line had each broken one of my rules. But what I saw was that the whole, and this was so important, what I saw was that the whole thing was a mental setup, made up in my mind. I determined the relationship. I determined the rules for the relationship. And that setup then is what allowed the betrayal. And what I saw is if I didn't have the setup, there could be no betrayal. So in this particular case, Jesus would have to say, Judas is my disciple, and this is how disciples must behave. He would have had all of that, he would have to have had all of that mental crap in his mind in order to see Judas as betraying him. And I think it's extremely possible, if not probable, that by the time we get to this point in the Jesus story, he didn't have all that crap in his mind, which means it would have been impossible for him to see Judas as betraying him, which means that the way he tells the story in the Course is actually more accurate. Again, he would have just seen Judas as confused, believing his thoughts, a script unfolding, based on the belief and thoughts, right? The script is the thoughts. So if you believe the thoughts, then the script unfolds. If you don't believe the thoughts, it doesn't have to. But a script is unfolding based on the believing of thoughts. And there's many people in this story who are believing thoughts. So this script has a pretty strong support system. And Jesus, who is about to check out by allowing the final end of the ego, is going to do nothing to interfere. He is now being the student. He's being the student as deeply as he can be because he's about to let go of the ego, the final letting go. And as the student, there's no way he's going to stand up and interfere. So that's the end of our reading today. Next week when we return, we will start at John chapter 14, verse 15, Jesus promises the Holy Spirit. So I will see you all then. Also, this Sunday, just to let you know, at the weekly gathering, our reading is going to be a letter from a prisoner that I received in the mail last week. It's actually to everyone in Awakening Together from a prisoner in California, and it's a highly inspirational letter. So please join us for the weekly gathering this Sunday morning. All right? Bye-bye.